appears to be a deliberate attempt by the authorities to destroy potential evidence of international crimes.
That is the United Nations Human Rights Chief talking about Myanmar and the Rohingya crisis. We'll have more in a moment. This is Thursday, the 8th of March, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Mel, and in Washington, you are part of this program. Please join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, Myanmar's civilian leader is stripped of a prestigious award in the United States. U.S. officials are expressing skepticism about North Korea's apparent offer to start talks with the U.S., and the U.S. asked China to come up with a plan to lower the trade deficit by $1 billion. All on today's VOA Asia. The United Nations Human Rights Chief said on Wednesday that he strongly suspected that acts of genocide may have taken place against Muslim Rohingyas in Myanmar's northern Rakhine State since August. His comments come as Myanmar's military published a lengthy response to widespread allegations over its campaign in Rakhine and said its investigations had cleared troops of almost all alleged abuses. Said Raad Al-Hussein said in a speech to the UN Human Rights Council that reports of bulldozing of alleged mass graves showed a deliberate attempt by the authorities to destroy evidence of potential international crimes.
This council is aware that my office has strong suspicions that acts of genocide may have taken place in Rakhine State since August. I am therefore not surprised by reports that Rohingya villages which were attacked in recent years and alleged mass graves of the victims are being bulldozed. This appears to be a deliberate attempt by the authorities to destroy potential evidence of international crimes. I have also received reports of the appropriation of land inhabited by Rohingya and their replacement by members of other ethnic groups.
The United Nations defines genocide as acts meant to destroy a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group in whole or in part. It was last December that Saeed said that Myanmar security forces may be guilty of committing genocide. A lot of work is being done. A lot of information is coming from the group Amnesty International. And we welcome to VOA Asia that group's Myanmar researcher, Laura Haig. Laura, tell us a little bit about the work that has gone into your research and how this has maybe led to what the United Nations is now saying.
Well, I think from Amnesty International's perspective, it's very clear that what we've seen from August last year is a widespread, systematic campaign of violence against the Rohingya community in northern Rakhine State. We've been in Bangladesh. We were in Bangladesh pretty much from the early days of September to record testimonies from Rohingya as they were crossing the border, fleeing for their lives, and they painted a very consistent picture of what was happening in northern Rakhine State. Killings, rape of women and girls, widespread destruction of homes through burning. I mean, basically, this has been an attempt, a campaign to drive the Rohingya out of northern Rakhine State, and to date, it has been very effective. Almost 700,000 Rohingya have left just in the matter of 6 months. For us, it's very clear that these are crimes against humanity, crimes under international law, and the international community really needs to step up now to ensure that the perpetrators, that's the Myanmar military, are going to be held to account for this.
Held to account for this when they just come out with a new report that clears troops of almost all alleged abuses. How do you react to that?
Well, I mean, sadly, that report is not surprising, and it follows what is a very established pattern of the Myanmar military essentially exonerating itself of accusations of human rights violations and whitewashing their crimes. This is not the first time that they've denied abuses against the Rohingya population, and unfortunately, as I say, it's a well-established pattern in Myanmar that the Myanmar military can get away and do get away with committing widespread human rights violations. That's not just true of Rakhine State. That's true of other parts of the country where they continue to commit war crimes, for example, Kachin State and Northern Shan State. And this, again, underscores why it's time for the international community to step up and send a very clear message to the military that, you know, these abuses won't go unpunished, that there will be an accounting for it. And, you know, that's very much the message that needs to be sent to the Human Rights Council as they discuss Myanmar next week.
Why hasn't it happened already?
I think there's been a certain lack of political will within the international community, and I think definitely there's been a tension between seeing the military as responsible for the abuses and then also understanding the limitations that the civilian administration faces. But ultimately, you know, this is not a political question. This is a question of international crimes. The international community has so far failed to take any meaningful action, really, to stem the abuses. And I think what we'd like to see as Amnesty is, you know, not only this push for accountability through international or internationalized courts, but actual measures to try and stop the Myanmar military from continuing these abuses, a global arms embargo, targeted sanctions against senior officials responsible for human rights violations. As I say, there is a message that needs to be sent to the military, and at the moment they're not getting it. They think they can just get away with this with pretty much blanket impunity.
With what you said being true, the agreement that has been reached between Bangladesh and Myanmar for some repatriation with thousands of names on a list, as we understand it, why would any Rohingya want to go back?
Exactly. I think that's a question that a lot of people are asking, not least because Rohingya actually continue to flee Myanmar even to this day. There are new arrivals in Bangladesh. Now they're not so much fleeing the massive burnings of properties and rape and killings. It's, you know, essentially they're being silently squeezed out of the state through forced starvation, through the threat of violence. Clearly that repatriation agreement is premature, and any Rohingya that would be forced back, that would be in itself a violation of international law. Of course the Rohingya have the right to return to Myanmar. You know, this is their home. This is where they're from. But at the moment, they can't return in safety and dignity. They'd be returning to live alongside the very security forces that have just driven them out of the country. And I think it's also important to remember that it's also a community that faces entrenched discrimination and segregation. You know, they have huge limitations on their movement. They can't access hospitals, education facilities. You know, what kind of life is there for them back in Myanmar?
You think the UN is doing enough?
The international community, frankly, isn't doing enough, hasn't done enough, and I don't think even now has fully grasped the severity of the situation. We do need to see concrete action. We're slowly starting to see it from some states, but it's not enough. We need targeted sanctions against senior officials who are responsible for these crimes, a global arms embargo to send a clear message to the military that these sorts of abuses won't go unpunished. And actually, we need the Security Council to start having serious discussions about accountability. You know, the UN is there to guide and to lead us when it comes to matters of international security and human rights, and they are unfortunately not doing that in the case of Myanmar. And the people who are suffering are not just the Rohingya, actually, it's the people of Myanmar as well.
Laura Haig is the Amnesty International Myanmar researcher. Laura, thank you so much for your time and your input. Now, later in the day, on Wednesday in the United States, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum rescinded a distinguished human rights award it presented to Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel laureate and civilian leader of Myanmar, for not stopping or recognizing the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya Muslim population in her Southeast Asian country. The Washington-based museum honored Aung San Suu Kyi with the Elie Wiesel Award in 2012, but announced it had been rescinded. A museum statement said under her leadership, the National League for Democracy has refused to cooperate with the United Nations, promoted hate speech against the Rohingya, and actively worked to prevent journalists from exposing the scope of the crimes in Myanmar's Rakhine State. We invite you to read more in our top stories by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Heavily armed suicide bombers attack a district police headquarters in southern Afghanistan late Wednesday, sparking an intense firefight with government security forces. Pakistan and India agreed to the exchange of civilian prisoners older than 70 years old, as well as females and inmates suffering from mental illness. And Sri Lanka has blocked access to social media sites to prevent the spread of violence against members of the minority Muslim population. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. U.S. officials are expressing skepticism about North Korea's apparent offer to start talks with the United States on abandoning its nuclear weapons. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, it is a promise Pyongyang has made before.
All right, Kim Jong-un's first ever meeting with South Korean officials led to what appeared to be a diplomatic breakthrough.
The North expressed its willingness for frank talks with the U.S. for discussing the issue of demilitarization and restoring U.S.-North Korea relations.
North Korea also reportedly is considering giving up its nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees from Washington. But in Washington, U.S. officials say not so fast.
Maybe this is a breakthrough. I seriously doubt it. But like I said, hope springs eternal.
Over the years, North Korea has promised on several occasions to give up its nuclear weapons in exchange for aid and other concessions from the West. But each time, the efforts fell through, and North Korea resumed its weapons programs. The question is whether the North's latest offer is genuine or another stalling tactic.
Well, we don't actually know what North Korea's demands may be. The statement that came out of South Korea was actually quite vague about what North Korea expects out of all of this. But it's very difficult for me to imagine them not at least agreeing to have talks and seeing what the North Koreans have to say.
At the White House Tuesday, President Trump responded cautiously.
We have come certainly a long way, at least rhetorically, with North Korea. It would be a great thing for the world. It would be a great thing for North Korea. It would be a great thing for the peninsula. But we'll see what happens.
Earlier, however, Trump tweeted, the U.S. is ready to go hard in either direction. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
We are happy you're with us here on VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump says his administration has asked China to come up with a plan to lower the trade deficit with the U.S. by $1 billion. Trump tweeted Wednesday, China has been asked to develop a plan for the year of a $1 billion reduction in their massive trade deficit with the United States. He touted good relations between the United States and China and said he looks forward to seeing what ideas China would come back with. He emphasized we must act soon. Trump followed with another tweet vowing the U.S. would fight against intellectual property theft, although he did not directly accuse China of the crime. He said the U.S. is acting swiftly on intellectual property theft. He said we cannot allow this to happen, as it has for many years. According to the Commerce Department, U.S.-China trade deficits rose to $375.2 billion in 2017. That's up from $347 billion in 2016. In an effort to avoid a possible trade war between the world's two largest economies, Chinese President Xi Jinping recently sent his top economic advisor, Liu He, to the White House, where he met with Trump administration officials to discuss trade and other issues. In recent months, Trump has repeatedly complained about the trade deficit, but has said he doesn't blame China for it. Instead, the president has criticized his predecessors for agreeing to what has been described as bad trade deals. In his efforts to lower the trade deficit, Trump has announced a series of steep tariffs on imported goods this year. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia: an Islamic university in Indonesia has been criticized after announcing it will not allow female students to continue to wear face veils on campus to graduate. An Afghan official is among two people killed in a suicide bombing. And Chinese leaders endorse an end to Xi's term limits. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. The Director General of the World Health Organization says he's establishing what he calls a health reserve army to tackle emergencies of newly emerging diseases. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says he has been spending the past 7 months working on a strategic plan to reform and improve the World Health Organization. The WHO chief says a major focus of this plan is on implementing swifter, more effective emergency response measures. Tedros notes this year marks the 100th anniversary of the Spanish flu, which killed up to 100 million people, far more than were killed during World War I. He says the world remains extremely vulnerable to potential pandemics and newly emerging diseases, and it must be prepared to respond to them quickly. He tells VOA it is crucial to work with countries on prevention in tackling these looming threats.
If anything happens, no country can do it alone, so we need to have a health reserve force, or if you like, health reserve army, in different locations, so countries who are better off can help other countries.
What he envisions, Tedros says, is the commitment of 50 countries that will have thousands of trained health workers on hand, ready to respond rapidly to medical emergencies wherever they occur. Tedros says he expects countries to cover their own expenses and help those that are unable to do so. Tedros, a former Ethiopian health minister and the first African to head the WHO, took office on July 1st. Back in October, he appointed then-Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe as a WHO goodwill ambassador. This move sparked an international outcry and nearly derailed Tedros's nascent administration. Mugabe had faced U.S. sanctions over his government's human rights abuses. The appointment was quickly rescinded. The WHO chief says the appointment was made in good faith, but he acknowledges the impact it had on the organization and voices regret. Tedros adds it is time to put the controversy behind him, however, and get on with the urgent health issues at hand. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This news alert from VOA Asia: aftershocks continue to strike the South Pacific island nation of Papua New Guinea following a powerful earthquake that rocked the land last week. The series of quakes has left 45 people dead. All the big stories coming your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, more people in Columbus, Ohio are now staying alive when their hearts suddenly develop an abnormal beat and then stop beating altogether. VOA's medical correspondent Carol Pearson tells us it's thanks to new procedures developed when a local hospital partnered with first responders.
Mark Bradford takes the same walk every day, but one morning he collapsed in sudden cardiac arrest. His heart stopped beating.
Next thing I remember is waking up in the heart unit.
With cardiac arrest, every second counts. How fast help arrives is a factor for survival. So too is what caused the heart to stop beating. If the heart quivers uncontrollably and can't pump blood, or if it goes wildly out of rhythm, chances of survival are slim to none. In the U.S., fire departments are called if there's an emergency. When the Columbus, Ohio Fire Department received a new device for CPR, the department contacted the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, and together they developed a new plan of action.
This will be an ECMO patient.
With that call, medics connect the patient to an automated CPR machine in the ambulance, while a team at the hospital prepares the catheterization laboratory, or cath lab. The lab has diagnostic imaging equipment so doctors can see the heart's arteries and chambers. Most patients who arrive at a hospital by ambulance go to the emergency room. At Ohio State, heart patients go immediately to the cath lab.
Getting people directly to the cath lab is critically important because the more time we wait, the more damage is done to the heart, the more damage is done to all of your organs, including your brain.
The patient is then connected to a machine that does the job of the heart and the lungs.
We can rest the heart and the lungs and then work, in this case, work on the heart to try to get it restarted and beating well.
This practice gives doctors better odds to fix what caused the heart to stop, and it gives patients a chance to survive. The hospital said the new protocol has increased survival rates from 0 to 40%.
Patients have a chance to walk out of a hospital with neurological recovery, having a meaningful life when essentially they would have been pronounced dead on the field.
Bradford was the first patient in Columbus, Ohio to benefit from the protocol.
I mean, I'm very fortunate that they were trained in it, that they used it, that I was out in the park rather than in the house by myself.
Doctors are hopeful this new procedure will eventually become standard and more lives will be saved. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
We've all heard a lot about self-driving cars. Forget it. Imagine a future filled with flying cars. This latest design comes from the Netherlands, where a company plans to officially unveil the newest combination of a gyrocopter and a sports car. VOA's George Pudich takes us for a test fly.
Assuming that you have about $600,000 extra cash and suitable places for takeoff and landing, this two-seater flying car called Pal V Liberty could be a lot of fun. It is based on a tried and proven concept of a gyrocopter that uses a rear-mounted vertical propeller to push it forward and a larger unpowered overhead rotor to keep it in the air. A number of similar aircraft are available, but this one has a closed cabin and three large wheels with suspension for driving on roads. Pal V's CEO Robert Dingemans says it's very safe because in case of engine failure, the overhead rotor serves as a parachute. For added safety, the gyrocopter also has two engines.
So when one engine would fail, which is very unlikely because they are redundant certified aviation engines, but if it would, you still have one left. And with this engine, you can still fly very far to find a very small spot to land it.
All systems have been thoroughly tested for all kinds of stresses. Pal V Liberty has a standard steering wheel and pedals, while flying controls are even simpler, a throttle control and a stick.
With the stick, you operate the rotor in different directions, so left is going left, right is going right, and if you push it forward, you go faster.
Conversion from a car to a gyrocopter and back is fully automated and takes only 10 minutes. It's rather thirsty engine, burns about 7 liters of regular auto fuel per hour with a top flying speed of about 180 kilometers per hour and a range of about 500 kilometers on a full tank. A pilot's license is required, but the training is measured in hours rather than days. The company is already receiving down payments for the first deliveries of its flying car, expected in 2019. George Pudich, VOA News.
We have our thank you to you for listening to VOA Asia. You can get this program other ways too, like on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. You can find us at voanews.com. Let's hear from you at VOA Asia Facebook and our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, David Byrd, and Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.